was that the total genetic capacity of a species may increase due to gene duplication. Reusing of old fossil copies of existing genes is one way in which this can happen. There are other, more immediate ways in which genes may be copied to widely distributed parts of the chromosomes, like files being duplicated to different parts of a disc or different discs.
Humans have 8 separate genes called globin genes, used for making hemoglobin, among other things, on various different chromosomes. It seems certain that all 8 have been copied ultimately from a single ancestral globin gene. About 1,100 million years ago, the ancestral globin gene duplicated, forming 2 genes. We can date this event because of independent evidence about how fast globins habitually evolve, as described in chapters 5 and 11. Of the 2 genes produced by this original duplication, 1 became the ancestor of all the genes that make hemoglobin in vertebrates. The other became the ancestor of all the genes that make myoglobins, a related family of proteins that work in muscles. Various subsequent duplications have given rise to the so-called alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and zeta globins. The fascinating thing is that we can construct a complete family tree of all the globin genes and even put dates on all the divergence points. Delta and beta globin parted company, for example, about 40 million years ago. Epsilon and gamma globins 100 million years ago. Yet the 8 globins, descendants as they are of these remote branchings in distant ancestors, are still all present inside every one of us. They diverged to different parts of an ancestor's chromosomes, and we have each inherited them on our different chromosomes. Molecules are sharing the same body with their remote molecular cousins. It is certain that a great deal of such duplication has gone on all over the chromosomes and throughout geological time. This is an important respect in which real life is more complicated than the biomorphs of Chapter 3. They all had only 9 genes. They evolved by changes in those 9 genes, never by increasing the number of genes to 10. Even in real animals, such duplications are rare enough not to invalidate the general statement that all members of a species share the same DNA addressing system.
Duplication within the species isn't the only means by which the number of cooperating genes has increased in evolution. An even rarer, but still possibly very important occurrence, is occasional incorporations from another species, even an extremely remote species. An especially important event along these lines, according to the increasingly favoured theory of the American biologist Lynn Margulis, took place at the origin of the so-called eukaryotic cell. Eukaryotic cells include all cells except those of bacteria. The living world is divided fundamentally into bacteria versus the rest. We are part of the rest and are collectively called the eukaryotes. We differ from bacteria mainly in that our cells have discrete little mini-cells inside them. These include the nucleus, which houses the chromosomes, the tiny bomb-shaped objects called mitochondria, which we met briefly when we were discussing the eye, filled with intricately folded membranes, and, in the cells of plants, chloroplasts. Mitochondria and chloroplasts have their own DNA, which replicates and propagates itself entirely independently of the main DNA in the chromosomes of the nucleus. All the mitochondria in you are descended from the small population of mitochondria that travelled from your mother in her egg. Mitochondria travel exclusively down the female line, and male bodies are dead ends as far as mitochondrial reproduction is concerned. Incidentally, this means that we can use mitochondria to trace our ancestry strictly down the female line.
Margulis's theory is that mitochondria and chloroplasts, and a few other structures inside cells, are each descended from bacteria. The eukaryotic cell was formed perhaps 2 billion years ago when several kinds of bacteria joined forces because of the benefits that each could obtain from the others. Over the eons, they've become so thoroughly integrated into the cooperative unit that became the eukaryotic cell that it has become almost impossible to detect the fact, if indeed it is a fact, that they were once separate bacteria. It seems that once the eukaryotic cell had been invented, a whole new range of designs became possible. Most interestingly from our point of view, cells could manufacture large bodies comprising many billions of cells. All cells reproduce by splitting into two, both halves getting a full set of genes. As we saw in the case of the bacteria on a pin's head, successive splittings into two can generate a very large number of cells in rather a short time. You start with one and it splits into two, then each of the two splits making four, each of the four splits making eight. The numbers go up by successive doublings from 8 to 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, 4096, 8192. After only 20 doublings, which doesn't take very long, we are up in the millions. After only 40 doublings, the number of cells is more than a trillion. In the case of bacteria, the enormous numbers of cells produced by successive doublings go their separate ways. The same is true of many eukaryotic cells, for instance protozoa such as amoebas. A major step in evolution was taken when cells that had been produced by successive splittings stuck together instead of going off independently. Higher order structure could now emerge, just as it did on an incomparably smaller scale in the two-way branching computer biomorphs.
Now, for the first time, large body size became a possibility. A human body is a truly colossal population of cells, all descended from one ancestor, the fertilized egg, and all therefore cousins, children, grandchildren, uncles, etc., of other cells in the body. The 10 trillion cells that make up each one of us are the product of a few dozens of generations of cell doublings. These cells are classified into about 210, according to taste, different kinds, all built by the same set of genes, but with different members of the set of genes turned on in different kinds of cells. This, as we have seen, is why liver cells are different from brain cells, and bone cells are different from muscle cells. Genes working through the organs and behavior patterns of many celled bodies can achieve methods of ensuring their own propagation that are not available to single cells working on their own. Many celled bodies make it possible for genes to manipulate the world using tools built on a scale that is orders of magnitude larger than the scale of single cells. They achieve these large-scale indirect manipulations via their more direct effects on the miniature scale of cells. For instance, they change the shape of the cell membrane. The cells then interact with one another in huge populations to produce large-scale group effects, such as an arm or a leg, or, more indirectly, a beaver's dam. Most of the properties of an organism that we are equipped to see with our naked eyes are so-called emergent properties. Even the computer biomorphs with their 9 genes had emergent properties. In real animals, they're produced at the whole body level by interactions between cells. An organism works as an entire unit, and its genes can be said to have effects on the whole organism, even though each copy of any one gene exerts its immediate effects only within its own cell. We have seen that a very important part of a gene's environment is the other genes that it is likely to meet in successive bodies as the generations go by. These are the genes that are permuted and combined within the species. Indeed, a sexually reproducing species can be thought of as a device that permutes a discrete set of mutually accustomed genes in different combinations. Species, according to this view, are continually shuffling collections of genes that meet each other within the species, but never meet genes of other species. But there is a sense in which the genes of different species, even if they don't meet at close quarters inside cells, nevertheless constitute an important part of each other's environment. The relationship is often hostile rather than cooperative, but this can be treated as just a reversal of sign. This is where we come to the second major theme of this chapter, arms races. There are arms races between predators and prey, parasites and hosts, even, though the point is a more subtle one, and I shan't discuss it further, between males and females within one species. Arms races are run in evolutionary time, rather than on the timescale of individual lifetimes. They consist of improvement in the survival equipment of one lineage, say prey animals, as a direct consequence of improvement in that of another, say predators. There are arms races wherever individuals have enemies with their own capacity for evolutionary improvement. I regard arms races as of the utmost importance, because it is largely arms races that have injected such progressiveness as there is in evolution. For, contrary to earlier prejudices, there is nothing inherently progressive about evolution. We can see this if we consider what would have happened if the only problems animals had had to face had been those posed by the weather and other aspects of the non-living environment.
After many generations of cumulative selection in a particular place, the local animals and plants become well fitted to the conditions, for instance, the weather conditions, in that place. If it is cold, the animals come to have thick coats of hair or feathers. If it is dry, they evolve leathery or waxy waterproof skins to conserve what little water there is. The adaptations to local conditions affect every part of the body, its shape and colour, its internal organs, its behaviour, and the chemistry in its cells. If the conditions in which a lineage of animals lives remain constant, say it is dry and hot and has been so without a break for 100 generations, evolution in that lineage is likely to come to a halt, at least as far as adaptations to temperature and humidity are concerned. The animals will become as well fitted as they can be to the local conditions. This doesn't mean that they couldn't be completely redesigned to be even better. It does mean that they can't improve themselves by any small and therefore likely evolutionary step. None of their immediate neighbours in the local equivalent of biomorph space would do any better. Evolution will come to a standstill until something in the conditions changes, the onset of an ice age, a change in the average rainfall of the area, a shift in the prevailing wind. Such changes do happen when we are dealing with a timescale as long as the evolutionary one. As a consequence, evolution normally does not come to a halt, but constantly tracks the changing environment. If there is a steady downward drift in the average temperature in the area, a drift that persists over centuries, successive generations of animals will be propelled by a steady selection pressure in the direction, say, of growing longer coats of hair. If, after a few thousand years of reduced temperature, the trend reverses and average temperatures creep up again, the animals will come under the influence of a new selection pressure and will be pushed towards growing shorter coats again.
But so far we have considered only a limited part of the environment, namely the weather. The weather is very important to animals and plants. Its patterns change as the centuries go by, so this keeps evolution constantly in motion as it tracks the changes. But weather patterns change in a haphazard, inconsistent way. There are other parts of an animal's environment that change in more consistently malevolent directions and that also need to be tracked. These parts of the environment are living things themselves. For a predator such as a hyena, a part of its environment that is at least as important as the weather is its prey, the changing population of gnus, zebras and antelopes. For the antelopes and other grazers that wander the plains in search of grass, the weather may be important, but the lions, hyenas, and other carnivores are important too. Cumulative selection will see to it that animals are well fitted to outrun their predators or outwit their prey, no less than it sees to it that they are well fitted to the prevailing weather conditions. And, just as long-term fluctuations in the weather are tracked by evolution, so long-term changes in the habits or weaponry of predators will be tracked by evolutionary changes in their prey, and vice versa, of course. We can use the general term enemies of a species to mean other living things that work to make life difficult. Lions are enemies of zebras. It may seem a little callous to reverse the statement to zebras are enemies of lions. The role of the zebra in the relationship seems too innocent and wronged to warrant the pejorative enemy. But individual zebras do everything in their power to resist being eaten by lions, and from the lion's point of view, this is making life harder for them. If zebras and other grazers all succeeded in their aim, the lions would die of starvation. So, by our definition, zebras are enemies of lions. Parasites such as tapeworms are enemies of their hosts, and hosts are enemies of parasites, since they tend to evolve measures to resist them. Herbivores are enemies of plants, and plants are enemies of herbivores, to the extent that they manufacture thorns and poisonous or nasty-tasting chemicals.
Lineages of animals and plants will, in evolutionary time, track changes in their enemies no less assiduously than they track changes in average weather conditions. Evolutionary improvements in cheetah weaponry and tactics are, from the gazelle's point of view, like a steady worsening of the climate, and they're tracked in the same kind of way. But there is one enormously important difference between the two. The weather changes over the centuries, but it does not change in a specifically malevolent way. It's not out to get gazelles. The average cheetah will change over the centuries, just like the mean annual rainfall changes. But whereas mean annual rainfall will drift up and down with no particular rhyme or reason, the average cheetah, as the centuries go by, will tend to become better equipped to catch gazelles than his ancestors were. This is because the succession of cheetahs, unlike the succession of annual weather conditions, is itself subject to cumulative selection. Cheetahs will tend to become fleeter of foot, keener of eye, sharper of tooth. However hostile the weather and other inanimate conditions may seem to be, they have no necessary tendency to get steadily more hostile. Living enemies, seen over the evolutionary timescale, have exactly that tendency. The tendency for carnivores to get progressively better would soon run out of steam, as do human arms races, for reasons of economic cost, which we shall come to, were it not for the parallel tendency in the prey, and vice versa. Gazelles, no less than cheetahs, are subject to cumulative selection, and they too will tend, as the generations go by, to improve their ability to run fast, to react swiftly, to become invisible by blending into the long grass. They too are capable of evolving in the direction of becoming better enemies, in this case, enemies of cheetahs. From the cheetah's point of view, the mean annual temperature does not get systematically better or worse as the years go by, except insofar as any change for a well-adapted animal is a change for the worse. But the mean annual gazelle does tend to get systematically worse, more difficult to catch because better adapted to evade cheetahs. Again, the tendency towards progressive improvement in gazelles would slow to a halt were it not for the parallel tendency to improvement shown by their predators. One side gets a little better because the other side has, and vice versa. The process goes into a vicious spiral on a timescale of hundreds of thousands of years.
In the world of nations on their shorter timescale, when two enemies each progressively improve their weaponry in response to the other side's improvements, we speak of an arms race. The evolutionary analogy is close enough to justify borrowing the term, and I make no apology to my pompous colleagues who would purge our language of such illuminating images. I've introduced the idea here in terms of a simple example, gazelles and cheetahs. This was to get across the important difference between a living enemy, which itself is subject to evolutionary change, and an inanimate, non-malevolent condition such as the weather, which is subject to change, but not systematic evolutionary change. But the time has come to admit that in my efforts to explain this one valid point, I may have misled the reader in other ways. It is obvious when you come to think about it that my picture of an ever-advancing arms race was too simple in at least one respect. Take running speed. As it stands so far, the arms race idea seems to suggest that cheetahs and gazelles should have gone on generation after generation, getting ever faster until both travelled faster than sound. This has not happened, and it never will. Before resuming the discussion of arms races, it is my duty to forestall misunderstandings. The first qualification is this. I gave an impression of a steady upward climb in the prey-catching abilities of cheetahs and the predator-avoiding abilities of gazelles. The reader might have come away with a Victorian idea of the inexorability of progress, each generation better, finer, and braver than its parents. The reality in nature is nothing like that. The timescale over which significant improvement might be detected is, in any case, likely to be far longer than could be detected by comparing one typical generation with its predecessor. The improvement, moreover, is far from continuous. It is a fitful affair, stagnating or even sometimes going backwards, rather than moving solidly forwards in the direction suggested by the arms race idea. Changes in conditions, changes in the inanimate forces I have lumped under the general heading of the weather, are likely to swamp the slow and erratic trends of the arms race, as far as any observer on the ground could be aware. There may well be long stretches of time in which no progress in the arms race, and perhaps no evolutionary change at all, takes place. Arms races sometimes culminate in extinction, and then a new arms race may begin back at square one. Nevertheless, when all this is said, the arms race idea remains by far the most satisfactory explanation for the existence of the advanced and complex machinery that animals and plants possess. Progressive improvement of the kind suggested by the arms race image does go on, even if it goes on spasmodically and interruptedly, even if its net rate of progress is too slow to be detected within the lifetime of a man, or even within the time span of recorded history.
The second qualification is that the relationship that we called enemy is more complicated than the simple bilateral relationship suggested by the stories of cheetahs and gazelles. One complication is that a given species may have two or more enemies, which are even more severe enemies of each other. This is the principle behind the commonly expressed half-truth that grass benefits by being grazed or mown. Cattle eat grass and might therefore be thought of as enemies of grass. But grasses also have other enemies in the plant world, competitive weeds which, if allowed to grow unchecked, might turn out to be even more severe enemies of grasses than cattle. Grasses suffer somewhat from being eaten by cattle, but the competitive weeds suffer even more. Therefore, the net effect of cattle on a meadow is that the grasses benefit. The cattle turn out to be, in this sense, friends of grasses rather than enemies. Nevertheless, cattle are enemies of grass in that it is still true that an individual grass plant would be better off not being eaten by a cow than being eaten, and any mutant plant that possessed, say, a chemical weapon that protected it against cows would set more seed containing genetic instructions for making the chemical weapon than rival members of its own species that were more palatable to cows. Even if there is a special sense in which cows are friends of grasses, natural selection does not favour individual grass plants that go out of their way to be eaten by cows. The general conclusion to this paragraph is as follows. It may be convenient to think of an arms race between two lineages, such as cattle and grass, or gazelles and cheetahs, but we should never lose sight of the fact that both participants have other enemies against whom they are simultaneously running other arms races. We won't pursue the point here, but it can be developed into one of the explanations for why particular arms races stabilize and do not go on forever and do not lead to predators pursuing their prey at Mach 2 and so on.
The third qualification to the simple arms race is not so much a qualification as an interesting point in its own right. In my hypothetical discussion of cheetahs and gazelles, I said that cheetahs, unlike the weather, had a tendency, as the generations go by, to become better hunters, to become more severe enemies, better equipped to kill gazelles. But this does not imply that they become more successful at killing gazelles. The kernel of the arms race idea is that both sides in the arms race are improving from their own point of view, while simultaneously making life more difficult for the other side in the arms race. There is no particular reason, or at least none in anything we've discussed so far, to expect either side in the arms race to become steadily more successful or less successful than the other. In fact, the arms race idea, in its purest form, suggests that there should be absolutely zero progress in the success rate on both sides of the arms race, while there is very definite progress in the equipment for success on both sides. Predators become better equipped for killing, but at the same time, prey become better equipped to avoid being killed, so the net result is no change in the rate of successful killings. The implication is that if, by the medium of a time machine, predators from one era could meet prey from another era, the later, more modern animals, whether predators or prey, would run rings round the earlier ones. This is not an experiment that can ever be done, although some people assume that certain remote and isolated faunas, such as those of Australia and Madagascar, can be treated as if they were ancient, as if a trip to Australia were like a trip backwards in a time machine. Such people think that native Australian species are usually driven extinct by superior competitors or enemies introduced from the outside world because the native species are older, out-of-date models, in the same position vis-à-vis invading species as a Jutland battleship contending with a nuclear submarine. But the assumption that Australia has a living fossil fauna is hard to justify. Perhaps a good case for it might be made, but it seldom is. I'm afraid it may be no more than the zoological equivalent of chauvinistic snobbery, analogous to the attitude that sees every Australian as an uncouth swagman with not much under his hat and corks dangling round the brim.
The principle of zero change in success rate, no matter how great the evolutionary progress in equipment, has been given the memorable name of the Red Queen effect by the American biologist Lee Van Valen. In Through the Looking Glass, you will remember the Red Queen seized Alice by the hand and dragged her faster and faster on a frenzied run through the countryside, but no matter how fast they ran, they always stayed in the same place. Alice was understandably puzzled, saying, "Well, in our country, you generally get to somewhere else if you ran very fast for a long time, as we've been doing." "A slow sort of country," said the Queen. "Now here, you see, it takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that."
The Red Queen label is amusing, but it can be misleading if taken, as it sometimes is, to mean something mathematically precise, literally zero relative progress. Another misleading feature is that in the Alice story, the Red Queen statement is genuinely paradoxical, irreconcilable with common sense in the real physical world. But Van Valen's evolutionary Red Queen effect is not paradoxical at all. It is entirely in accordance with common sense, so long as common sense is intelligently applied. If not paradoxical, however, arms races can give rise to situations that strike the economically minded human as wasteful.
Why, for instance, are trees in forests so tall? The short answer is that all the other trees are tall, so no one tree can afford not to be. It would be overshadowed if it did. This is essentially the truth, but it offends the economically minded human. It seems so pointless, so wasteful. When all the trees are the full height of the canopy, all are approximately equally exposed to the sun, and none could afford to be any shorter. But if only they were all shorter, if only there could be some sort of trade union agreement to lower the recognized height of the canopy in forests, all trees would benefit. They would be competing with each other in the canopy for exactly the same sunlight, but they would all have paid much smaller growing costs to get into the canopy. The total economy of the forest would benefit, and so would every individual tree. Unfortunately, natural selection doesn't care about total economies, and it has no room for cartels and agreements. There has been an arms race in which forest trees became larger as the generations went by. At every stage of the arms race, there was no intrinsic benefit in being tall for its own sake. At every stage of the arms race, the only point in being tall was to be relatively taller than neighbouring trees. As the arms race wore on, the average height of the trees in the forest canopy went up. But the benefit that the trees obtained from being tall did not go up. It actually deteriorated because of the enhanced costs of growing. Successive generations of trees got taller and taller, but at the end they might better, in one sense, have stayed where they started.
Here then is the connection with Alice and the Red Queen, but you can see that in the case of the trees, it is not really paradoxical. It is generally characteristic of arms races, including human ones, that although all would be better off if none of them escalated, so long as one of them escalates, none can afford not to. Once again, by the way, I should stress that the story has been told too simply. I do not mean to suggest that in every literal generation, trees are taller than their counterparts in the previous generation, nor that the arms race is necessarily still going on. Another point illustrated by the trees is that arms races do not necessarily have to be between members of different species. Individual trees are just as likely to be harmfully overshadowed by members of their own species as by members of other species. Probably more so, in fact, for all organisms are more seriously threatened by competition from their own species than from others. Members of one's own species are competitors for the same resources to a much more detailed extent than members of other species. There are also arms races within species between male roles and female roles, and between parent roles and offspring roles. I've discussed these in The Selfish Gene and will not pursue them further here.
The tree story allows us to introduce an important general distinction between two kinds of arms race, called symmetric and asymmetric arms races. A symmetric arms race is one between competitors trying to do roughly the same thing as each other. The arms race between forest trees struggling to reach the light is an example. The different species of tree are not all making their livings in exactly the same way, but as far as the particular race we are talking about is concerned, the race for the sunlight above the canopy, they are competitors for the same resource. They are taking part in an arms race in which success on one side is felt by the other side as failure. And it is a symmetric arms race because the nature of the success and failure on the two sides is the same, attainment of sunlight and being overshadowed, respectively. The arms race between cheetahs and gazelles, however, is asymmetric. It is a true arms race in which success on either side is felt as failure by the other side, but the nature of the success and failure on the two sides is very different. The two sides are trying to do very different things. Cheetahs are trying to eat gazelles. Gazelles are not trying to eat cheetahs, they are trying to avoid being eaten by cheetahs. From an evolutionary point of view, asymmetric arms races are more interesting since they're more likely to generate highly complex weapons systems. We can see why this is by taking examples from human weapons technology. The existence of a successful offensive weapon, such as the Exocet type of surface skimming missile, tends to invite the invention of an effective countermeasure, for instance a radio jamming device to confuse the control system of the missile. The countermeasure is more likely than not to be manufactured by an enemy country, but it could be manufactured by the same country, even by the same company. No company, after all, is better equipped to design a jamming device for a particular missile than the company that made the missile in the first place. There is nothing inherently improbable about the same company producing both and selling them to opposite sides in a war.
I am cynical enough to suspect that this probably happens, and it vividly illustrates the point about equipment improving while its net effectiveness stands still and its costs increase. From my present point of view, the question of whether the manufacturers on opposite sides of a human arms race are enemies of each other or identical with each other is irrelevant, and interestingly so. What matters is that, regardless of their manufacturers, the devices themselves are enemies of each other in the special sense I've defined in this chapter. The missile and its specific jamming device are enemies of each other in that success in one is synonymous with failure in the other. Whether their designers are also enemies of each other is irrelevant, although it will probably be easier to assume that they are. So far, I've discussed the example of the missile and its specific antidote without stressing the evolutionary progressive aspect, which is, after all, the main reason for bringing it into the chapter. The point here is that not only does the present design of a missile invite or call forth a suitable antidote, say a radio jamming device, the anti-missile device in its turn invites an improvement in the design of the missile, an improvement that specifically counters the antidote, an anti-anti-missile device. It is almost as though each improvement in the missile stimulates the next improvement in itself via its effect on the antidote. improvement in equipment feeds on itself. This is a recipe for explosive, runaway evolution.
At the end of some years of this ding-dong invention and counter-invention, the current version of both the missile and its antidote will have attained a very high degree of sophistication. Yet at the same time, here is the Red Queen effect again, there is no general reason for expecting either side in the arms race to be any more successful at doing its job than it was at the beginning of the arms race. Indeed, if both the missile and its antidote have been improving at the same rate, we can expect that the latest, most advanced and sophisticated versions, and the earliest, most primitive and simplest versions, will be exactly as successful as each other against their contemporary counter-devices. There has been progress in design, but no progress in accomplishment, specifically because there has been equal progress in design on both sides of the arms race. Indeed, it is precisely because there has been approximately equal progress on both sides that there has been so much progress in the level of sophistication of design. If one side, say the anti-missile jamming device, pulled too far ahead in the design race, the other side, the missile in this case, would simply cease to be used and manufactured, it would go extinct. Far from being paradoxical, like Alice's original example, the Red Queen effect, in its arms race context, turns out to be fundamental to the very idea of progressive advancement.
I said that asymmetric arms races were more likely to lead to interesting progressive improvements than symmetric ones, and we can now see why this is, using human weapons to illustrate the point. If one nation has a 2-megaton bomb, the enemy nation will develop a 5-megaton bomb. This provokes the first nation into developing a 10-megaton bomb, which in turn provokes the second into making a 20-megaton bomb, and so on. This is a true progressive arms race. Each advance on one side provokes the counter-advance on the other, and the result is a steady increase in some attribute as time goes by, in this case explosive power of bombs. But there is no detailed one-to-one correspondence between the designs in such a symmetric arms race, no meshing or interlocking of design details as there is in an asymmetric arms race, such as that between missile and missile jamming device. The missile jamming device is designed specifically to overcome particular detailed features of the missile. The designer of the antidote takes into account minute details of the design of the missile. Then, in designing a counter to the antidote, the designer of the next generation of missiles makes use of his knowledge of the detailed design of the antidote to the previous generation. This is not true of the bombs of ever-increasing megatonnage. To be sure, designers on one side may pirate good ideas, may imitate design features from the other side. But if so, this is incidental. It is not a necessary part of the design of a Russian bomb that it should have detailed one-to-one correspondences with specific details of an American bomb. In the case of an asymmetric arms race between a lineage of weapons and the specific antidotes to those weapons, it is the one-to-one correspondences that, over the successive generations, lead to ever greater sophistication and complexity. In the living world, too, we shall expect to find complex and sophisticated design wherever we are dealing with the end products of a long, asymmetric arms race, in which advances on one side have always been matched on a one-to-one, point-for-point basis by equally successful antidotes, as opposed to competitors, on the other. This is conspicuously true of the arms races between predators and their prey, and perhaps even more, of arms races between parasites and hosts. The electronic and acoustic weapon systems of bats, discussed in Chapter 2, have all the finely tuned sophistication that we expect from the end products of a long arms race. Not surprisingly, we can trace this same arms race on the other side. The insects that bats prey upon have a comparable battery of sophisticated electronic and acoustic gear. Some moths even emit bat-like ultrasounds that seem to put the bats off. Almost all animals are either in danger of being eaten by other animals or in danger of failing to eat other animals, and an enormous number of detailed facts about animals make sense only when we remember that they are the end products of long and bitter arms races. H.B. Cott, author of the classic book Animal Coloration, put the point well in 1940, in what may be the first use in print of the arms race analogy in biology.
Before asserting that the deceptive appearance of a grasshopper or butterfly is unnecessarily detailed, we must first ascertain what are the powers of perception and discrimination of the insect's natural enemies. Not to do so is like asserting that the armor of a battlecruiser is too heavy or the range of her guns too great without inquiring into the nature and effectiveness of the enemy's armament. The fact is that in the primeval struggle of the jungle, as in the refinements of civilized warfare, we see in progress a great evolutionary armament race, whose results for defense are manifested in such devices as speed, alertness, armor, spinescence, burrowing habits, nocturnal habits, poisonous secretions, nauseous taste, and camouflage and other kinds of protective coloration. And for offense, in such counter-attributes as speed, surprise, ambush, allurement, visual acuity, claws, teeth, stings, poisoned fangs, and lures. Just as greater speed in the pursued has developed in relation to increased speed in the pursuer, or defensive armor in relation to aggressive weapons, so the perfection of concealing devices has evolved in response to increased powers of perception.
Arms races in human technology are easier to study than their biological equivalents because they're so much faster. We can actually see them going on from year to year. In the case of a biological arms race, on the other hand, we can usually only see the end products. Very rarely a dead animal or plant fossilizes, and it is then sometimes possible to see progressive stages in an animal arms race a little more directly. One of the most interesting examples of this concerns the electronic arms race, as shown in the brain sizes of fossil animals. Brains themselves do not fossilize, but skulls do, and the cavity in which the brain was housed, the brain case, if interpreted with care, can give a good indication of brain size. I said, if interpreted with care, and the qualification is an important one. Among the many problems is the following.
Big animals tend to have big brains, partly just because they are big, but this doesn't necessarily mean that they are, in any interesting sense, cleverer. Elephants have bigger brains than humans, but probably with some justice, we like to think that we are cleverer than elephants and that our brains are really bigger if you make allowance for the fact that we are much smaller animals. Certainly our brains occupy a much larger proportion of our body than elephants' brains do, as is evident from the bulging shape of our skulls. This is not just species vanity. Presumably a substantial fraction of any brain is needed to perform routine caretaking operations around the body, and a big body automatically needs a big brain for this. We must find some way of taking out of our calculations that fraction of brain that can be attributed simply to body size so that we can compare what is left over as the true braininess of animals. This is another way of saying that we need some good way of defining exactly what we mean by true braininess. Different people are at liberty to come up with different methods of doing the calculations, but probably the most authoritative index is the encephalization quotient, or EQ, used by Harry Jerison, a leading American authority on brain history. The EQ is actually calculated in a somewhat complicated way, taking logarithms of brain weight and body weight and standardizing against the average figures of a major group, such as the mammals as a whole. Just as the intelligence quotient, or IQ, used, or it may be misused, by human psychologists, is standardized against the average of a whole population, the EQ is standardized against, say, the whole of the mammals. Just as an IQ of 100 means, by definition, an IQ identical to the average for a whole population, so an EQ of 1 means, by definition, an EQ identical to the average for, say, mammals of that size. The details of the mathematical technique don't matter. In words, the EQ of a given species, such as a rhino or a cat, is a measure of how much bigger or smaller the animal's brain is than we should expect it to be given the animal's body size. How that expectation is calculated is certainly open to debate and criticism. The fact that humans have an EQ of 7 and hippos an EQ of 0.3 may not literally mean that humans are 23 times as clever as hippos. But the EQ as measured is probably telling us something about how much computing power an animal has in its head over and above the irreducible minimum of computing power needed for the routine running of its large or small body. Measured EQs among modern mammals are very varied. Rats have an EQ of about 0.8, slightly below the average for all mammals. Squirrels are somewhat higher, about 1.5. Perhaps the three-dimensional world of trees demands extra computing power for controlling precision leaps, and even more for thinking about efficient paths through a maze of branches that may or may not connect farther on. Monkeys are well above average, and apes, especially ourselves, even higher. Within the monkeys, it turns out that some types have higher EQs than others and that, interestingly, there is some connection with how they make their living. Insect-eating and fruit-eating monkeys have bigger brains, for their size, than leaf-eating monkeys. It makes some sense to argue that an animal needs less computing power to find leaves, which are abundant all around, than to find fruit, which may have to be searched for, or to catch insects, which take active steps to get away. Unfortunately, it's now looking as though the true story is more complicated and that other variables, such as metabolic rate, may be more important. In the mammals as a whole, carnivores typically have a slightly higher EQ than the herbivores upon which they prey. You will probably have some idea about why this might be, but it is hard to test such ideas. Anyway, whatever the reason, it seems to be a fact. So much for modern animals. What Gerrison has done is to reconstruct the probable EQs of extinct animals that now exist only as fossils. He has to estimate brain size by making plaster casts of the insides of brain cases. Quite a lot of guesswork and estimation has to go into this, but the margins of error are not so great as to nullify the whole enterprise. The methods of taking plaster casts can, after all, be checked for their accuracy using modern animals. We make believe that the dried skull is all that we have from a modern animal, use a plaster cast to estimate how big its brain was from the skull alone, and then check with the real brain to see how accurate our estimate was. These checks on modern skulls encourage confidence in estimates of long-dead brains. His conclusion is, firstly, that there is a tendency for brains to become bigger as the millions of years go by. At any given time, the current herbivores tended to have smaller brains than the contemporary carnivores that preyed on them. But later herbivores tended to have larger brains than earlier herbivores, and later carnivores larger brains than earlier carnivores. We seem to be seeing, in the fossils, an arms race, or rather a series of restarting arms races, between carnivores and herbivores. This is a particularly pleasing parallel with human armament races, since the brain is the onboard computer used by both carnivores and herbivores, and electronics is probably the most rapidly advancing element in human weapons technology today.
How do arms races end? Sometimes they may end with one side going extinct, in which case the other side presumably stops evolving in that particular progressive direction, and indeed it will probably even regress for economic reasons soon to be discussed. In other cases, economic pressures may impose a stable halt to an arms race, stable even though one side in the race is, in a sense, permanently ahead. Take running speed, for instance. There must be an ultimate limit to the speed at which a cheetah or a gazelle can run, a limit imposed by the laws of physics. But neither cheetahs nor gazelles have reached that limit. Both have pushed up against a lower limit, which is, I believe, economic in character. High-speed technology is not cheap. It demands long leg bones, powerful muscles, capacious lungs. These things can be had by any animal that really needs to run fast, but they must be bought. They are bought at a steeply increasing price. The price is measured as what economists call opportunity cost. The opportunity cost of something is measured as the sum of all the other things that you have to forego in order to have that something. The cost of sending a child to a private fee-paying school is all the things that you can't afford to buy as a result, the new car that you can't afford, the holidays in the sun that you can't afford. If you're so rich that you can afford all these things easily, the opportunity cost to you of sending your child to a private school may be next to nothing. The price to a cheetah of growing larger leg muscles is all the other things that the cheetah could have done with the materials and energy used to make the leg muscles, for instance, make more milk for cubs. There is no suggestion, of course, that cheetahs do cost accounting sums in their heads. It is all done automatically by ordinary natural selection. A rival cheetah that doesn't have such big leg muscles may not run quite so fast, but it has resources to spare for making an extra lot of milk, and therefore perhaps rearing another cub. More cubs will be reared by cheetahs whose genes equip them with the optimum compromise between running speed, milk production, and all the other calls on their budget. It isn't obvious what the optimum trade-off is between, say, milk production and running speed. It will certainly be different for different species, and it may fluctuate within each species. All that is certain is that trade-offs of this kind will be inevitable. When both cheetahs and gazelles reach the maximum running speed that they can afford, in their own internal economies, the arms race between them will come to an end.
Their respective economic stopping points may not leave them exactly equally matched. Prey animals may end up spending relatively more of their budget on defensive weaponry than predators do on offensive weaponry. One reason for this is summarized in the Aesopian moral, "The rabbit runs faster than the fox because the rabbit is running for his life while the fox is only running for his dinner." In economic terms, this means that individual foxes that shift resources into other projects can do better than individual foxes that spend virtually all their resources on hunting technology. In the rabbit population, on the other hand, the balance of economic advantage is shifted towards those individual rabbits that are big spenders on equipment for running fast. The upshot of these economically balanced budgets within species is that arms races between species tend to come to a mutually stable end with one side ahead. We are unlikely to witness arms races in dynamic progress because they are unlikely to be running at any particular moment of geological time, such as our time. But the animals that are to be seen in our time can be interpreted as the end products of an arms race that was run in the past.
To summarize the message of this chapter, genes are selected not for their intrinsic qualities, but by virtue of their interactions with their environments. An especially important component of a gene's environment is other genes. The general reason why this is such an important component is that other genes also change as generations go by in evolution. This has two main kinds of consequences. First, it has meant that those genes are favored that have the property of cooperating with those other genes that they are likely to meet in circumstances that favor cooperation. This is especially, though not exclusively, true of genes within the same species, because genes within one species frequently share cells with one another. It has led to the evolution of large gangs of cooperating genes, and ultimately to the evolution of bodies themselves as the products of their cooperative enterprise. An individual body is a large vehicle or survival machine built by a gene cooperative for the preservation of copies of each member of that cooperative. They cooperate because they all stand to gain from the same outcome, the survival and reproduction of a communal body, and because they constitute an important part of the environment in which natural selection works on each other. Second, circumstances don't always favor cooperation. In their march down geological time, genes also encounter one another in circumstances that favor antagonism. This is especially, though not exclusively, true of genes in different species. The point about different species is that their genes don't mix, because members of different species can't mate with one another. When selected genes in one species provide the environment in which genes in another species are selected, The result is often an evolutionary arms race. Each new genetic improvement selected on one side of the arms race, say predators, changes the environment for selection of genes on the other side of the arms race, prey. It is arms races of this kind that have been mainly responsible for the apparently progressive quality of evolution, for the evolution of ever-improving running speed, flying skill, acuity of eyesight, keenness of hearing, and so on. These arms races don't go on forever, but stabilize when, for instance, further improvements become too economically costly to the individual animals concerned.
This has been a difficult chapter, but it had to go into the book. Without it, we would have been left with the feeling that natural selection is only a destructive process, or at best, a process of weeding out. We have seen two ways in which natural selection can be a constructive force. One way concerns cooperative relationships between genes within species. Our fundamental assumption must be that genes are selfish entities working for their own propagation in the gene pool of the species. But because the environment of a gene consists to such a salient degree of other genes also being selected in the same gene pool, genes will be favoured if they are good at cooperating with other genes in the same gene pool. This is why large bodies of cells working coherently towards the same cooperative ends have evolved. This is why bodies exist, rather than separate replicators still battling it out in the primordial soup. Bodies evolve integrated and coherent purposefulness because genes are selected in the environment provided by other genes within the same species. But because genes are also selected in the environment provided by other genes in different species, arms races develop. And arms races constitute the other great force propelling evolution in directions that we recognize as progressive, complex design. Arms races have an inherently unstable runaway feel to them. They career off into the future in a way that is, in one sense, pointless and futile, in another sense, progressive and endlessly fascinating to us, the observers. The next chapter takes up a particular, rather special case of explosive runaway evolution, the case that Darwin called sexual selection.
Chapter 8. Explosions and Spirals. The human mind is an inveterate analogizer. We are compulsively drawn to see meaning in slight similarities between very different processes. I spent much of a day in Panama watching two teeming colonies of leafcutter ants fighting, and my mind irresistibly compared the limb-strewn battlefield to pictures I'd seen of Passchendaele. I could almost hear the guns and smell the smoke. Shortly after my first book, The Selfish Gene, was published, I was independently approached by two clergymen who both had arrived at the same analogy between ideas in the book and the doctrine of original sin. Darwin applied the idea of evolution in a discriminating way to living organisms changing in body form over countless generations. His successors have been tempted to see evolution in everything, in the changing form of the universe, in developmental stages of human civilizations, in fashions in skirt lengths. Sometimes such analogies can be immensely fruitful, but it is easy to push analogies too far and get overexcited by analogies that are so tenuous as to be unhelpful or even downright harmful. I've become accustomed to receiving my share of crank mail and have learned that one of the hallmarks of futile crankiness is over-enthusiastic analogizing. On the other hand, some of the greatest advances in science have come about because some clever person spotted an analogy between a subject that was already understood and another still mysterious subject. The trick is to strike a balance between too much indiscriminate analogizing on the one hand and a sterile blindness to fruitful analogies on the other. The successful scientist and the raving crank are separated by the quality of their inspirations. But I suspect that this amounts in practice to a difference not so much in ability to notice analogies as in ability to reject foolish analogies and pursue helpful ones. Passing over the fact that we have here yet another analogy, which may be foolish or may be fruitful, and is certainly not original, between scientific progress and Darwinian evolutionary selection, let me now come to the point that is relevant to this chapter. This is that I'm about to embark on two interwoven analogies